Imagine you're suddenly drop into the middle of this vast freezing ocean.
Oh, terrifying.
Right. Like the water is barely above freezing. These massive waves are just towering over you, and the current is violently pulling you under. Plus, the sky is pitch black.
Sounds like a nightmare.
It really is.
Yeah.
And your immediate biological instinct in that moment is to just thrash. Your amygdala totally takes over, flooding your entire system with adrenaline.
Which makes sense, right? It's survival.
Exactly. You fight the water, you panic, you try to like literally claw your way out of the ocean itself. You're expending every single ounce of your energy, just violently resisting the reality of the cold.
Which is, ironically, a guaranteed way to just exhaust yourself and sink. I
Yeah.
mean, you're burning through your limited reserves, fighting the sheer existence of the ocean, rather than, using that energy to figure out how to actually stay afloat in it.
Which brings us perfectly to today's topic. Welcome to this deep dive, everyone. That freezing ocean is really the perfect entry point for our mission today.
It's a great metaphor.
Thanks. So we're looking at a comprehensive 66-chapter workbook, which is rooted in both ancient philosophy and like modern neuroscience, called the RAFT program.
Yes, the RAFT program.
And our specific goal today is to extract the core insights from Chapter 7, which focuses entirely on the mechanics of compassion.
Right, and just to give you some context on how that fits in, the RAFT program is designed as a really practical guide for navigating life's most turbulent waters. And it uses this very specific framework.
Oh, right, the acronym.
Exactly. The acronym RAFT stands for Recognize, Abandon, Feel, and Train. It's a deliberate progression.
So it's a step-by-step thing.
Totally step by step.
Right.
And to understand where compassion fits into all this, we have to look at that very first stage, which is recognize.
Right. And to understand what it is we're actually recognizing, the text takes us way back to a foundational idea from ancient philosophy.
This is where it gets really profound.
It really does. We're introduced to Gautama, the Buddha's first realization. And, that realization is simply that existence, by its very nature, inherently comes with pain, difficulty, and, disappointment.
The ancient term they use for that is dukkha.
Dukkha, right. It basically represents those dangerous, turbulent waters that we're all, perpetually trying to navigate.
Yeah, it serves as the ultimate reality check. It's that moment where you stop thrashing in the freezing water and simply admit, okay, I am in the ocean and it is freezing.
Yeah, just accepting the baseline reality.
Right. Recognizing that undeniable reality is the essential first step before you can even begin to, like, construct a vessel that's capable of surviving that environment.
Okay, let's unpack this because simply recognizing pain isn't enough to save you, right? Like, just knowing the water is cold doesn't magically keep you from drowning.
No, definitely not.
It's how we respond to that dangerous shore, the actual mechanics of our response to pain, that dictates whether we sink or float. And I think that brings us directly to the central structural metaphor of the raft program.
Yeah, exactly. So when you're building a mental and emotional raft to carry you across these waters, you obviously need a rigid structure.
Right, you need something solid.
Right. The text outlines that the foundational wooden planks of our raft are what they call the five gifts.
The five gifts.
Yeah. And these represent a very strict commitment to harmlessness. Specifically, it's the intention not to harm living beings, not to take what isn't freely given, and to maintain integrity in, like, our actions, our speech, and our consumption.
So we've laid down these sturdy wooden planks of good intentions and harmless actions. But I mean, if you throw a bunch of unconnected loose planks into a stormy ocean,
They're just going to scatter.
exactly, they don't form a raft. The moment the water gets rough, they just drift apart. And then you're left holding like a single piece of wood while the rest of your good intentions literally just float away.
Yeah, which is why planks need binding. They require something flexible and resilient to hold them all together under pressure.
Makes sense.
And in the raft program, that binding the rope that secures the entire structure is woven from four appropriate responses. Traditionally, these are known as the four Brahmaviharas.
And the four strands of that rope are compassion, friendliness, appreciative joy, and equanimity, right?
You got it.
And the text really emphasizes that compassion is the very first strand to be woven, which, the reason for that is tied directly to our biological response to pain.
Oh, absolutely.
Because when we recognize pain, whether it's our own internal suffering or someone else's, our default physiological reaction is almost always aversion.
We just want to push it away.
Yeah, push it away, or we fall into denial and pretend it doesn't hurt, or we just like completely collapse into despair.
We go right back to thrashing in the freezing water.
Exactly. But compassion, well, it functions entirely differently on a mechanical level. Compassion actually acknowledges the reality of the pain. It says, okay, this hurts. This is really difficult. But it does so without adding that secondary layer of resistance or judgment.
It's such a crucial distinction. Think of it like an actual physical rope. If you bind a raft with something completely rigid, like iron chains, right? The first massive wave is just going to snap the chains and shatter the wood.
Oh, wow, that's a great visual.
Yeah. Compassion provides the necessary flexibility. It allows the raft to, absorb the kinetic impact of the wave, bend with the water, and actually remain intact.
So if a wooden planks are our actions in the world, like our rigid commitments to do no harm, then the rope is the attitude we hold ourselves with.
Exactly. The attitude secures the actions.
Because without the flexible attitude of compassion, the moment we face real compounding stress, those rigid planks of our good intentions are just gonna snap. I mean, we might act perfectly for a while, but we desperately need the flexibility of self-kindness to hold those actions together when the environment becomes hostile.
Yeah, but the waves crashing against the outside of the raft aren't the only threat to its structural integrity.
Sure.
The real test of this framework often happens internally, because when we ignore how the raft is maintained on the inside, rot develops from the inside out.
And that internal rot is exactly what the raft program addresses when it shifts focus to the human struggle with craving and avoidance.
Right. And what's fascinating here is how the text systematically dismantles the way modern society views compulsive and reactive behaviors.
It totally flips the script.
It really does. We are deeply, deeply conditioned to view these behaviors as inherent moral failures. Like when someone engages in patterns of escape and self-sabotage, the immediate cultural response is character assassination.
Oh, 100%. We just assume they have a lack of willpower or a fundamental weakness or, a broken moral compass.
Exactly. But Gautama taught a vastly different dynamic. The text argues that these patterns of escape and self-sabotage are not moral failings at all.
Right.
They're actually misguided, desperate attempts to escape suffering. They're just clumsy tools used to numb an underlying intolerable pain.
Which completely shifts the paradigm of how we address the problem. I mean, it means the reactive behavior isn't even the root issue, right? The behavior is just an ineffective coping strategy.
Right. The actual problem is the unresolved pain underneath.
Exactly. And when we meet those misguided attempts with harsh self-judgment, shame, and isolation, we don't cure the behavior. We actually manufacture the exact psychological environment where those negative patterns become entirely necessary for survival.
Yeah, we end up fueling the shame cycle.
Let's map out how that actually works, just for clarity. So a person feels a sudden, intense spike of anxiety or pain, and because they don't have the tools to process it, they engage in compulsive and reactive behaviors just to numb that distress.
Makes sense biologically.
Right. But the moment the numbing wears off, they feel intense, isolating shame about what they just did. But shame is literally just another form of excruciating pain. So to escape the new pain of the shame, they have to repeat the behavior.
It's a closed loop.
It is a
Yeah.
closed biological loop of suffering.
And the raft program is unambiguous about how to dismantle that loop. It says replacing self-hatred with self-compassion is the only functional way to break the cycle.
The only way.
Yeah. You cannot shame a nervous system into feeling safe. Shame isolates you, and the program explicitly notes that no one completes this journey from bondage to freedom single-handed.
Right. Connection is key.
Connection is what sustains the journey, and compassion is basically the fundamental architecture of connection, beginning with how you connect to yourself.
Okay, I have to play devil's advocate for a moment here because this is the exact point where a lot of people listening will probably throw their hands up.
Oh, I know what you're going to say.
Right. The immediate pushback is always that offering ourselves compassion when we engage in patterns of escape and self-sabotage is just like letting ourselves off the hook.
Yep, the complacency argument.
Exactly. It feels like it breeds complacency. It sounds like saying, well, I just blew up my life, but I'm going to be gentle with myself and avoid taking any real accountability.
I hear that all the time, but that is the most persistent myth about self-compassion, that it functions as some sort of free pass.
Right.
But when we look closely at the fear of complacency, the biological data actually tells a completely different story. The text delves into the hard science to demonstrate that self-compassion is a physiological imperative for sustainable change.
Yes. The neuroscience behind this is what really solidifies the argument. the text draws a very sharp neurological line between empathy and compassion.
Which a lot of people don't realize are different.
Totally. We tend to use those words interchangeably in everyday conversation, but in the brain, they trigger entirely different cascades.
How so?
Well, when you experience pure empathy, meaning you're purely mirroring the pain of someone else or drowning in your own unmitigated pain, it activates the pain matrix in your brain.
Right. And that mirroring is why empathy alone often leads to severe emotional burnout. I mean, your amygdala is firing, your body's producing stress hormones, and you are literally simulating the suffering.
Exactly.
But compassion, neurologically speaking, does not just mirror the pain. It combines the awareness of the pain with an active underlying desire to alleviate it.
That's the key difference.
Yeah, that slight shift in intention actually changes the neural pathway. Compassion activates the striatum and other areas of the brain associated with reward, affiliation, and the readiness to take action.
So it's proactive.
Exactly. It's a forward-moving, mobilized state, whereas pure empathy can be paralyzing.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting, because the RAFT program explains that practicing self-compassion directly impacts the vagus nerve.
Oh, the vagus nerve, yes.
Yeah. For context, the vagus nerve is the superhighway of the parasympathetic nervous system. It's responsible for all those rest and digest functions. And when you actively practice self-compassion, you physically increase both your heart rate variability and your vagal tone.
And the mechanism there is so crucial. Higher vagal tone means your nervous system has a much stronger physical brake pedal.
Right.
Like when a stressor hits, your heart rate naturally spikes. But with high vagal tone, your body can pull that heart rate back down to a resting state much faster.
You recover faster.
Exactly.
Yeah.
By actively practicing self-compassion, you aren't just engaging in, like, positive thinking. You are literally signaling your vagus nerve to physically slow your heart. You're basically upgrading the emotional shock absorbers of your nervous system.
And that biological reality completely invalidates the whole complacency argument, right?
Totally.
You aren't letting yourself off the hook by being compassionate. You are biologically equipping your nervous system to endure the reality of the hook without completely shutting down.
That's a great way to put it.
And the psychological framework provided by Dr. Kristen Neff in the text supports this perfectly.
Yes. Dr. Neff's research is absolutely the clinical bedrock for this approach.
She breaks self-compassion down into three active mechanical parts, which I love. The first is self-kindness, which is just the direct active opposite of that harsh inner critic.
Right. Quieting that voice.
Exactly. The second is common humanity. And this means framing your suffering and your imperfection as a shared human experience rather than like an isolating anomaly.
Oh, that's huge.
It is. Because instead of thinking I'm uniquely broken and I'm the only one who struggles like this, you recognize that struggle is just the baseline of the human condition.
And that second component, common humanity, is what punctures the isolation of the shame cycle we discussed earlier.
Exactly. And then the third part is mindfulness. In this context, mindfulness just means holding a balanced awareness of your difficult feelings.
So not ignoring them.
Right. You don't suppress them, but you also don't over-identify with them and let them define your entire reality. And when you combine those three elements, self-kindness, common humanity, and mindfulness, the clinical data shows a massive reduction in anxiety and a really significant increase in resilience.
It is just remarkable to see modern clinical data perfectly validate ancient philosophical insights.
Isn't it?
Yeah. In fact, the text connects this clinical framework back to an 8th century philosopher named Synthadeva.
Oh, the way Synthadeva frames this is so grounding.
It really is.
Like, think about the last time you saw a stranger violently stub their toe on the sidewalk. You instinctively flinched, right?
Oh, yeah. You feel it.
You felt a flash of their pain. Well, Synthadeva argued that this flinch proves something really radical, that pain is simply pain. It doesn't inherently belong to anyone.
Wow.
There is no meaningful fundamental difference between your pain and my pain. It's just a phenomenon that arises, and it should be addressed simply because it is suffering, regardless of whose body it occurs in.
It levels the playing field completely. My pain, your pain, it's a condition waiting to be met with care.
Exactly.
And Gotama actually taught this exact balance using the metaphor of a bird's two wings. He referred to wisdom and compassion as the two wings of the path.
Two wings, right.
Yeah, you have warm wisdom and wise compassion. Because if a bird only has the wing of cold analytical wisdom, it plummets.
It just drops.
Right. But if it only has the wing of warm, boundaryless compassion, it just flies in endless circles.
Yeah.
You need the clarity of wisdom to accurately see the reality of the suffering. and the warmth of compassion to actually hold it without breaking.
That's a beautiful metaphor. And, you know, understanding the vagus nerve and the ancient philosophy is incredibly validating, but we have to translate this into the friction of daily life, you know?
Oh, totally. Theory is great, but practice is harder.
Right. So how do we take this concept of the two wings or the rope of compassion and actually apply it when the water is actively pulling us under? Like when we are caught right in the grip of the human struggle with craving and avoidance, how do we weave this rope in real time?
Well, the RAFT program provides highly specific mechanical tools for those exact moments, which is great.
Good.
One of the most effective approaches it outlines actually changes the entire way we interact with a craving.
Because normally when a craving hits, the immediate instinct is to just go to war with it.
Right. To fight it.
We treat the craving like this hostile invader trying to breach the walls of the raft. We try to suppress it or fight it or just distract ourselves from it as hard as we can.
Yeah, but the program suggests dropping the weapons entirely.
Dropping them.
Yeah. Instead of fighting the craving, it asks you to meet it at the door and get intensely curious. You just pause, you bring in that warm wisdom, and you ask the craving a direct question. What unmet need are you pointing to?
Oh, wow. What unmet need are you pointing to? That just diffuses the entire struggle right there.
It really does.
You stop treating the craving as this demon trying to destroy your progress, and you start treating it like, I don't know, an exhausted, clumsy messenger.
That's exactly what it is.
Because the craving is just trying to alert you that a vital need is not being met. Like maybe you're profoundly lonely or physically exhausted or feeling entirely unseen in your relationships.
Yes.
The craving is just the brain's desperate, highly inefficient attempt to solve that underlying deficit.
Right. Asking what unmet need are you pointing to is the active practice of self-compassion. You are acknowledging the distress signal without adding the secondary pain of fighting the messenger.
I love that. And, you know, the program extends this practical toolkit outward as well.
Oh, with the Just Like Me practice.
Yes, the Just Like Me practice. It's designed to be used when you're dealing with difficult people, though it's honestly just as effective when turned inward.
How does it work?
Well, think about the person who rudely steals your parking spot at the grocery store.
Ugh, the worst.
Right. The immediate physical reaction is a spike in heart rate and just a flood of judgment. Like they are a terrible, selfish person.
That aversion is absolutely the default setting.
But the practice asks you to interrupt that default setting with a very specific internal monologue.
Okay.
You look at that person and silently reflect, this person, just like me, wants to be happy.
Yeah.
This person, just like me, has experienced profound pain, grief, and loss.
Right.
This person, just like me, is fumbling through life, doing the best they can with the tools they have.
Wow. If we connect this to the bigger picture,
yeah,
you know, that internal monologue is the active application of common humanity.
Exactly.
It immediately dismantles the barrier of judgment.
Yeah.
What becomes evident is that caring for others organically arises when we practice self-compassion. Mm-hmm. We begin to recognize our shared, flawed human condition.
Yeah, it bridges the gap.
Because when you deeply understand how difficult it is to carry your own unmet needs, you naturally extend grace to someone who is clumsily trying to manage theirs. Caring for others and caring for ourselves operate on the exact same biological and emotional circuitry.
It's literally the flexible rope of the Brahma-Viharas holding the entire structure together.
Yes, exactly.
And for those moments when the wave crashing over the raft is so massive that you just can't muster up a profound philosophical reflection.
Which happens to all of us.
Totally. The text provides a very simple internal emergency protocol. It uses Kristen Neff's specific self-compassion phrases that you can just quietly whisper to yourself.
They function as a mental lifeline when the panic sets in.
They really do. You simply pause, breathe, and silently say, this is a moment of suffering.
Which satisfies the mindfulness component.
Right, just validating the raw data of reality. Then you say, suffering is part of life.
And that triggers the common humanity component.
Exactly, reminding your brain that you aren't isolated in this experience. And finally you say, may I give myself the compassion I need.
May I give myself the compassion I need. It is a quiet, profound rebellion against the mechanics of the shame cycle.
It really is a rebellion.
Because even if the physical sensation of the anxiety doesn't immediately evaporate, the act of intentionally offering yourself kindness radically shifts your internal environment. It signals the vagus nerve, applies the brake pedal, and gives your raft the flexibility it desperately needs to survive the impact.
So what does this all mean for you? When we pull back and look at the entirety of Chapter 7 of the RAFT program, the core insight is that compassion is never just a passive warm sentiment.
Not at all.
It is a highly active, biologically necessary mechanism for survival. It's the crucial rope that binds the rigid planks of our raft together.
It holds it all intact.
Yeah. It provides the structural flexibility required to actually navigate the dangerous waters ahead rather than just endlessly, exhaustingly thrashing in the cold.
It provides the internal fortitude to look at the terrifying reality of our own pain and respond by saying, I see exactly what this is, and I will treat it with care.
Treat it with care.
Right. That act of care is the only thing that sustains the long journey from bondage to freedom.
Well said. Now, for those of you listening who want to explore the mechanics of this further, the RAFT to Freedom workbook is written by Dr. Catherine Jacob and Vince Cullen.
It's an amazing resource.
It is, and they are currently making the entire 66 chapters freely available online. You can access the complete program at raft2freedom.org. That is RAFT, the number 2, freedom.org.
It is an invaluable resource to dive into. And before we conclude today, we want to invite you to engage in a self-reflection directly from the chapter itself.
Oh, I love this one.
Yeah. Take a moment today to consider your typical response when faced with difficulty. When you make a mistake, is your inner voice harsh or is it kind?
Such an important question.
And if a close friend were your position, what kind words would you offer them? And can you offer yourself the same?
That simple inquiry has the power to just completely rewire how you interact with your own mind. It perfectly echoes the mandatory concluding quote we have from the end of the chapter, which goes, unlike self-criticism, which asks if you're good enough, self-compassion asks, what's good for you? Kristen Neff.
To leave you with one final thought to mull over as you go about your day, if every craving, sudden frustration, or compulsive urge is just a neon sign pointing to an unmet need, what is the most mundane, everyday annoyance you are experiencing right now, quietly trying to ask you for?